From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codename Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's the top of the week, which means it is time for some strange news. Every time we're preparing for this, we sift through dozens, or in some cases, hundreds of weird stories that you may not have heard, and they take us to some strange places. We're going to talk about a possible flashpoint for World War III. We're going to talk about the crushing issue of debt. We're also going to get down with cocaine and submarines. These are all three true things. I'm wondering where we would like to start today. Do you guys feel like a crime story?
Oh, I love a good crime story. You know, my mom calls those, she calls them crimmies, because we lived in Germany for a while. She goes, I gotta watch my crimmies.
Well, we will not disappoint with this creamy.
Creamy.
Whatever. Creamy crimmies in the mornings. Here we go. So let's begin by introducing you to a character named Marty Tibbetts. Marty Tibbetts. He is the CEO of a thing called Clementine Live Answering Service. Now, what in the heck is that, you might ask? An answering service? I haven't used one of those in years. What is that? Well, it's a company that specializes in assisting other companies in taking in phone calls, making sure those phone calls go to the right people, responding to some with a staff of people, or just, you know, kind of just organizing those messages and, like I said, sending them to the right place. It seems to be a fairly functional business and makes quite a bit of money, because Mr. Marty Tibbetts, who was the CEO of Clementine Live Answering Service, lived in a home that was worth $6.4 million. Okay, right? Who knows what Mr. Tibbetts did in the rest of his life to get enough money to afford a home like that, but my goodness, that is lovely. And can you imagine just the costs of the staff that you would need to run a home that's worth $6.4 million. Good God. Well, the reason why we're talking about him today is because he is also known as Dale Johnson. He's got an AKA to his name. Now, why would a CEO of a tech company have an AKA like that?
I love a CEO with an cool AKA, Matt.
Cool to have him. I think everybody should have some AKAs, some aliases. Yeah. I mean, Why stick with one name? Science says you're only here one time. Do what you can.
You always know that today was a good day because you didn't even have to use your AKA.
Oh, I guess that's true. Yeah. Having an alternate persona is very common to us now. Many of us have them for online purposes, right? For existing on the internet, for existing on social media. That's cool. That's a thing. But to have a... what is described by the Daily Beast as a generic code name is a little different, right? It's a little different. So why would he have this? Well, according to prosecutors who are dealing with several issues in the world of drug trafficking, say that this person, Marty Tibbetts, was also a drug trafficker. He was providing money and funding operations for a global drug trafficking ring. That's according to prosecutors. Another thing you should know about Marty Tibbetts, he was a very big aviation buff. He started a museum called the World Heritage Aviation Museum in Detroit, Michigan. And it has now been shuttered, but he started this thing that had all kinds of vintage fighter jets, vintage planes, other vintage flying machines that were there. He was very fascinated by it, and he was also a pilot. He was able to fly several of these things, and on occasion, he would fly vintage jets, like actual old jets. And on one occasion in 2018, he was flying a fighter jet, an older fighter jet. And this plane, for one reason or another, went down. It nosedived into a barn somewhere in Wisconsin, and he was killed.
Along with 50 cows. Yeah, 50 cow crash.
Oh, yes. The cows. Leave the cows out of it.
There was definitely collateral damage.
Oh, no! Oh, amazing.
Sorry, guys. So that's, you know, tragic. A man dies doing what he loves, flying one of these fighter jets. And not a lot was known about Mr. Tibbetts and his actions or his alleged actions until the public was made aware of another person, Yili Didani, who was identified as physically running operations of this drug trafficking ring. So someone who was a little more hands-on than perhaps Marty was. Because, you see, it appears that Marty was very much a money cleaner, somebody who would transfer money safely for this group of people, somebody who was able to provide funds when necessary. This is a very strange story, especially because everyone who knew Marty Tibbetts, at least according to people who have been interviewed, according to official statements that have been put out publicly, had no idea that Marty had anything to do with this organization or with this kind of organized crime.
The people the next mansion over are like, he was such a nice tycoon. You know what I mean? He had all the cool tycoon hobbies. He was a neat guy, kind of guy you could sort of set your watch to. You know what I mean?
And he wasn't too ostentatious. His yacht was just right, just the right size.
Yes. Which is interesting because, you know, that's how you get away with this stuff for a while. You are not flashy. And right. As weird as it sounds to say this guy recreationally flies planes, this guy owns an opulent mansion, that's still not particularly flashy in his income bracket.
Mm-hmm.
Very true. He's a CEO. He makes some good bucks, gets those big bonuses, and he's doing what he can to keep, I'm sure, keep that money making money. Right. That's what the wealthy do. By the way, this is in Michigan. Oh, I'm trying to pull up my Google Earth link, but it's so mad that we're doing a Zoom call right now, you guys. I was going to tell you about the area. It's called Grosse Pointe, Michigan.
Yeah,
it's a lovely area. There is not a house on the shoreline here in the area where Mr. Tibbetts lived that doesn't look like it's upwards of $5 million, if not 12. It's ridiculous. Check it out. Grosse Pointe Park, Michigan. There's Grosse Pointe, Michigan, Grosse Pointe Park, Michigan. I believe he was in the park area.
Yeah, this is like, think of it kind of like a wealthy suburb of Detroit. It borders Detroit. It's kind of its own thing, but a lot of the movers and shakers in Detroit particularly will live in Grosse Pointe Park.
Yeah. It's the Buckhead of the area. I don't know.
Or the Johns Creek, maybe?
It could be the Johns Creek.
Is that where that movie Grosse Pointe Blank takes place, where Timothy, what's his name? Not Timothy Dalton. He was in Beautiful Girls. Anyway, he was kind of an America's Sweetheart actor, and he plays like it's John Cusack, Grosse Pointe Blank. He's like an assassin, and he's going back to his high school reunion in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, I believe.
Wow, that's cool. I did not know that. It's going to make me want to rewatch that just to look at the area. So let's talk about a couple of the things that are alleged here that Marty was doing, because one of them is really weird. You heard Ben mention submarines at the top of this episode. Well, we'll get you there. But first, let's talk about the investigation that details really activities that start in 2015. So in 2016, Marty is said to have issued a check for $864,000. This went allegedly, according to them, directly to the cartel, which authorities think was, it ended up getting cashed at some kind of cash exchange business, like a pawn shop, gold, you know, we buy gold kind of exchange. Then he apparently was in Washington, D.C. and personally gave a $350,000 to Dadani, this other person. You'll need Dadani. He just like flew in, gave him $350K and then got out. And according to them, he provided the cartel over $1.8 million in cash and, I guess, assets of some sort, but probably dealing with easily movable money like cash. The other thing that Tibbetts was doing for Dadani, or as almost an R&D project that they had going on, they were devising a submarine, or they wanted to come up with a submarine, small remote-controlled submersible, that would be able to be filled with cash and or cocaine, probably both, and then make its way underneath the water and have magnets on it where it could attach itself to another ship, probably a shipping vessel, and then travel with that shipping vessel undetected across the world and land in another country in a customs area, probably right before they get into a customs area, detach itself, and then a fishing vessel or some other, you know, private vessel could come out and pick the thing up. They were developing this with a third-party company. Allegedly, they paid $12,000 to just get it up and running. But then, unfortunately, Marty Tibbetts died in that plane crash, and they scrapped that concept. And also, allegedly, with Marty gone, Yelena Dadani had serious issues keeping the organization together, you know, making these transactions occur, getting funding that was needed to make the transactions occur. And everything started falling apart. And that's when authorities were able to come in and start working on Dadani. And eventually they arrested him this year.
And just to be clear, there's nothing fishy about the plane crash at this time.
At least, yes, at this time, there's nothing fishy about it. It doesn't help that it was an older aircraft that, you know, isn't flown by a lot of people these days. And, you know, you are talking about a very experienced pilot. So you'd think, I don't know. It's one of those regions where I'm never not going to think something fishy happens when a plane crash occurs.
But the submarine is literally more fishy. We can agree.
Well, just by virtue of its location. Yeah, for sure. Matt, when you say older plane, are we talking about like some sort of like classic plane, like that isn't even around anymore because of his collection, or just maybe, you know, something from like the 80s or 90s? An older model.
Unfortunately, I do not have all of the information.
I'm picturing it being like a biplane or something, but that's just let my imagination run wild with that one, if
you
don't mind.
No, it's not a biplane. It's a fighter jet.
Oh, got it. Whoa. Okay.
And you can online, allegedly, at least if you believe TechGate and some of the other places here, you can see footage of the jet itself going or making its way down into the barn itself.
Is that legal, though? Do you have to have a special license to fly something like that?
I'm sure. And I'm sure he also had it. He ran a whole museum. He
got it.
I mean, you can see pictures of him in the cockpit of a fighter jet wearing all the correct gear. He seems to be a fascinating dude. I did want to bring up something interesting that came to my mind as I was researching Marty Tibbetts. Have you guys seen that show Ozark?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The main character on there, played by the director and creator, his name is Marty Bird. Mm-hmm. Now, he plays a financial...
consultant, advisor.
A financial advisor.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That has been working for a cartel for a long time and then ends up moving to, you know, the Ozarks in this case, but in the middle of nowhere by the shore. Specifically to be by the shore with all that shoreline. Mm-hmm. His name's Marty. It's based on, you know, nothing. It's just a character that they created out of whole cloth. And then all of a sudden we hear or we learn about this guy named Marty who was doing kind of the same thing. I just want to, you know, I want to know the story that some retired official or some FBI agent told to Jason Bateman some late night at a bar or something.
Some like big fish, white whale that got away. Mm-hmm. Also, the submarine technology is legitimately impressive. A lot of drug cartel submarines are definitely clandestine DIY affairs, nonetheless impressive, but they're built to go much shorter distances, right? And they're super dangerous as well. Yeah. It's a heck of a gamble. So that's probably why they wanted to make it unmanned vehicle.
Well, and it's very tiny. The thing at scale is very tiny, but it is plenty space to put, you know, a ton of kilo, like a bunch of kilos in there, and then run the thing a very short distance to that ship.
And we're going to talk more about evil submarines later in today's episode. Nice.
That's right. That's right.
Awesome.
So, you know, if you've heard anything about this situation, or you know any interesting characters that live in a mansion that try to develop submarines or helicopters or whatever, we'd love to hear about it. So would my dog. Yeah. And for now, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back with more strange news.
And we're back with more strange news. I'm doing something a little different today for my strange news. It's a story, while it maybe isn't like a specific news item, it was a specific coverage of a longstanding strange and to many disturbing item covered by a favorite, I think, of all of ours, Mr. John Oliver on Last Week Tonight. On the most recent episode, he did his long segment that he does at the end of the show on the national debt. And, you know, on the surface, this could seem like a super dry concept, but it turns out it's really not. And he does such a great job of kind of demystifying what the national debt is. I believe we're in the neighborhood of $28 trillion in the national debt, which is divided up in some pretty interesting ways. You know, there's a lot made out of like, oh, China owns us. You know, China has so much stake in, you know, the United States. And, you know, what if that debt comes due? Oliver points out beautifully and snarkily, that's not really how that works. It's not like these things come due where all of a sudden we owe China $1.07 trillion that we have to pay all up at once. And Oliver makes a really great point about how essentially, you know, in the same way that having a bit of debt as an individual kind of is a way to invest in, say, a business or, you know, in a home, like having debt that is ultimately represents equity is a positive thing. Like you're in debt, you know, for your mortgage, but you're also building equity. And so the idea is not about
F you, buddy.
Hey,
no, just joking.
I'm just saying, like, you know, the idea is debt can be good for you because it is ultimately a method to build equity and to do things that you need. And all that applies to us as a country, too. Like we, you know, all of this debt, this, you know, 28, whatever trillion dollars in debt, it's all about how you use it, right? So it's not like, oh God, we're in debt. We're just digging ourselves deeper and deeper. And different presidents handle it differently, whether it's through tax cuts or raising taxes to kind of even things out. And Oliver points out how, you know, Ronald Reagan was kind of the granddaddy of fiscal conservatism, or, you know, the idea of, well, we got to, you know, count our pennies and balance the debt or balance the budget and all that. Or sorry, reduce the debt and balancing the budget. Those are two different things. We're not going to get too in the weeds with that. But Oliver also points out that subsequent presidents and their handling of it and the way that the different parties have kind of looked upon this idea of debt bad or debt good has really fluctuated depending on who the president is. And, you know, for example, George W. Bush really ballooned the national debt by cutting taxes for the wealthy, primarily, people above a certain income bracket, which typically ends up being the wealthy. Same thing that our last president did. And we have historically seen that these types of tax cuts for the, you know, super wealthy don't really trickle down to normal people, as some would hope or have, you know, made the case for.
Pretended,
A million, but exactly. I'm trying to be diplomatic, but you're absolutely right, Ben. What ends up happening then, Ben? If they're not investing back in jobs and infrastructure, whatever, what do they do with those those earnings?
Well, in some cases, a certain segment of the ultra wealthy here in the U.S. would buy debt, would take the money they had saved, right, and buy more, because you can, you know, debt is a thing that you can buy, right? You can hold someone's debt. So
yeah,
there's that. Also, fun fact, this gets, I love bringing this up whenever we talk about this. Trickle-down economics had another name that got changed to sound a little bit more, you know, approachable and correct. It used to be called, I believe it was, the original concept was something like horse and sparrow economics.
Yeah.
And the idea was that you don't have to feed the sparrows. You just feed the horse as many oats as it wants. And then when it defecates, there will be just enough left in there for the sparrows to survive by eating the poop.
Oh, and so trickle down always has made me think of being pissed on by the rich.
Right.
Just
right.
For the record, that's just the image there. So I wouldn't say that's that much better, because horse and sparrow is so vague that you'd have to kind of like go into it like you just did, Ben. I would not have immediately thought of that being a poop metaphor.
It's but literally trickle, them yeah. saying eat shit.
Each yeah. And trickle down, though, I instantly think of pee rolling downhill onto the less wealthy of us amongst us. So that's all a thing. And then, of course, when, you know, Barack Obama became the president, he was blamed for a lot of these things that kind of he inherited. And that's always how it goes. You know, you get blamed for what happens before your watch, because then it becomes your watch and then it's yours. It's an easy thing to spin.
And to be fair, you get credit if you're a president. Since a president only serves a 4 to 8 year term, you get credit for good things that a previous yes. administration may have done that
yes.
don't really come into effect for a
seeds
while.
Seeds
right?
that are planted with things like these choices, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the point that Oliver makes. And, you know, it's worth watching the whole segment and the whole episode. It's just a great show. But I really want to chat with you guys about this briefly. I'll quit kind of summarizing in a second. But I did want to point out one thing that I really want to get into. This whole idea of, you mentioned it, Ben, you can buy debt. You can own debt. And it's like you can treat it as a commodity. And that's what all of these countries do. They're investing in our country, essentially, and buying a piece of it. And then, like a country like China that's so heavily invested, the value of the dollar, correct me if I'm wrong, Ben, it actually has an impact on the value of their currency, because they're so invested in us that it actually almost becomes like, you know, a symbiotic relationship between these two currencies, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're correct. It's, and I love that you point out this kind of debt is not like the kind of debt you might encounter as an individual. You know what I mean?
No.
And it's funny, if you look behind the curtain, it seems like the larger institutions get, the more lax they tend to be about paying debt on time. But I think where you're going here, Noel, if I'm correct, my telepathy isn't on the fritz. Are we about to talk about bonds? Treasury bonds?
Absolutely. Because it turns out that, yeah, China does own a hefty portion of our debt, but it's only like 5% of the overall debt. And the people that own most of the United States debt are, the United States citizens who are invested in these treasury bonds, because they're safe places to park your money. And, you know, it's looked at as like patriotic. Maybe I'm oversimplifying it, Ben, but I think that's pretty close to the truth.
I would say you're absolutely right, because there's a predictability to it. It's not buying a bond. A treasury bond is not it's like an IOU that will come to fruition without a lot of fluctuation. At least that's the understanding. And of course, it has that selling value. You know, back in the 1950s, you guys probably have seen these commercials before where it's like, buy wall bonds,
mm-hmm.
Which were meant to, you know, you're kind of purchasing this, again, not to be repetitive, but you're purchasing sort of an IOU. And because that's a predictable investment vehicle, it makes sense that people would want to get in the game. I mean, we've probably got some folks listening now who have a couple bonds locked away in a safe somewhere, or I don't know, on your coffee table. I don't know what everybody's houses look like. I don't know how you handle bonds.
And they don't accrue insane interest, but they're super safe. And if you were given one, like, you know, or someone was holding one that they bought like in the 20s and they pass on to you, it's probably super valuable now, you know, over time. And it's never going to like lose value. But back to the China thing, like, so again, this idea of China, we're being beholden to China, that's sort of a myth. And that's sort of perpetuated by a lot of folks that want to fearmonger and kind of make people scared of our potential Chinese overlords. And it turns out that China isn't even the top foreign investor in the U.S. debt. It's actually been surpassed by Japan, who holds $1.26 trillion in U.S. debt. And China's down to $1.07. And it may well be that that was triggered by the trade war that Trump sort of instituted against China, you know, that kind of messed with their exports because they need their economy to be thriving for them to invest in like other economies.
I agree with you, but I think it's been bolstered. But I remember hearing rhetoric about debt to China and essentially economic competition with China. Like, that's been going around for quite a while. Oh, exactly. In political circles.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Since the days of Nixon, when he, quote unquote, opened a new phase of relationship with U.S. and China.
But this idea that they could trigger some sort of economic catastrophe on command if they so chose, that's not a thing, right?
Not really. Like, you could, it's like saying, I'm in traffic, and it's like you're driving in traffic and you're saying, you know, anybody behind or in front of me could do something that would totally wreck my car. The problem is, it gets very close to like mutually assured financial destruction because these things are all interconnected. So, in the analogy of the car accident, if you saw someone and you didn't like them, and you were having a bad day and you thought like this injustice will not stand, yeah, you could totally drive your car into their car. It would also destroy your car. You know what I mean? It's not logical yet for that to happen. It doesn't mean it'll always be that way in the future, but these, you know, a lot of what countries, especially superpowers, want, whether they're regional or world superpowers, they want a measure of predictability and sustainability. So even when you hear crazy rhetoric sold to the domestic Chinese public or sold to the domestic Western public, I guarantee you there's always another meeting where the the government officials sit down in a room together, often especially after presidents or prime ministers change, and they go, look, I know you and the guy before me had some issues, but I'm the kind of person you can work with. Okay. So maybe we can both figure out, and then they lay out their list of compromise. After that, it's just like negotiating a contract, really. But I think, Noel, one thing that makes this a little bit different is now China is rapidly expanding, is moving from a regional to a world superpower. And I think that's where a lot of that rhetoric that we all hear is coming from. You raise a really good point about how it's mischaracterized in the public sphere. You know what I mean? Like when people used to try to ramp up racist fears about which country supplies U.S. oil, right? Mm-hmm. When it turned out those percentages were also wackadoo. I think it's something that definitely bears some thinking about. And obviously, we're all big fans of John Oliver. I don't know about you guys, but it makes my day whenever they do a segment on something that we had covered.
Oh, always. And I love how high production value that show is, but they save it all for the last segment, like all that money. And in this episode, a lot of the rhetoric and the clips they play are people historically saying, oh, you know, we're robbing Peter to pay Paul and we're putting our children at risk. And it's all about the future of our children. But the point he makes is like, well, okay, but if we invested this money, this debt, into like better roads and infrastructure and things like New Deal type programs and things that created jobs and, you know, education, things that have historically been kind of stripped by Republicans. I'm not trying to make this a partisan-y discussion. It's just this is true. Historically, there was an interview with Axios did with Ted Cruz, where he basically cops to being a member of a party that is historically kind of not been the best steward of this kind of debt. And, you know, it gets spent on things like military resources instead of like roads. The roads in Atlanta, garbage. I'm constantly angry about where my tax money goes because I'm always like falling into potholes and stuff. And I'm like, what am I getting for this? I don't have health care that's worth a damn. My roads suck. I can't get my kid into a good, worthwhile school without it being private or charter and really inconvenient. So what am I getting? And I don't know. I just feel like if I thought that that was being, I would pay more tax if I thought that it was going somewhere of value to me and my life, you know? I don't know how you guys feel, but that's my hot take.
I think that's a perfectly logical way to look at it. You know, so the idea of taxation is heavily politicized in this country because the system is broken, right? That's what happened. People don't agree on how it's broken, and they certainly don't agree on how to fix it. But we know that it has codified loopholes that aid and abet the people who are involved in writing those laws. That is, or their masters. That is just a fact. But if you think about it in a non-political way, then the best way to say it is like this. Picture your country, wherever you live, as a club, like a country club. Why not? That's not super creative, but we're going with it.
Taxes are your dues, right? Taxes are your dues.
Right. So taxes, when the systems work, are the dues you pay to keep the country club looking nice, to keep the lights and the water on, to maybe have, you know, the get-togethers for special occasions.
Yeah, birthday parties.
Like sure, birthday parties, whatever. Quinceañeras,
bat mitzvahs. To pay all the employees' salaries and health care?
To pay the employees, yeah. Like these are, and the idea is that you, if you are the average person, could not on your own start a country club. Like I would never, you know, I'm not super into the idea myself, but like, why would I start the Ben Bolin Country Club and be the only member? That's just me having a house with a silly sign on it.
Oh, but I would feel really sad if I wasn't invited to join the Ben Bolin Country Club, and I would pay dues for that. No, I think it's an absolutely appropriate representation of how this stuff works. And let me add this, if you don't mind. And if you were paying those dues and you were going to this country club, and every time you went out to play golf, you fell into a sinkhole, you probably wouldn't want to be a member of that club anymore. You'd probably be asking some very serious questions about where those dues went. And if the answer was, oh, you know, we just like pocket them or like, you know, launder them elsewhere, whatever. I'm not trying to accuse the government of that, but you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, like, we're paying our private security force to go to a neighboring country club
and colonize
so
them.
That they can establish amenities for that country club that we don't have here.
Right.
Vietnam War.
Or, you know, wow, we're supposed to get a free, like, we're supposed to have a free cafe, right? Because we pay dues. We don't have a free cafe, but the accountant is pushing a new Maserati. I feel like I paid for that Maserati and I don't think that's cool. Mm-hmm. Why do I still have to go here? The difference is that when we're talking about a country instead of a country club, countries are much more difficult to leave. You could just walk out of the club. You could just quit your membership. Renouncing your citizenship over taxation is a much more extreme move.
Well, and that's my point. It almost feels like these dues we pay is literally just for the privilege of being allowed to hang around. And, you know, it's like our gym is supposed to be this full service gym, but it's actually just like a bunch of spoons taped together in the middle and like a single kettlebell chained to a radiator, you know? And it's like, you know, this is what you get. And I'm obviously overstating the case here a little bit. I love the United States. I love living in this country, but when you look at it and what you get for this tax, it starts to feel a little out of whack with other countries that have socialized healthcare and, you know, better roads and amenities. And it's just, it starts to get a little old after a while, especially when you look at this ballooning national debt. But it does feel like we're kind of moving in the right direction with some of these, you know, New Deal-esque programs. I think even the most vehement fiscal conservative or people, you know, Republican would probably say that the New Deal stuff was a pretty good idea. It left us with some very lasting, you know, infrastructure foundationally. That now we need to service or build some new stuff. And also everyone pretty much agrees that it created a lot of jobs, which gave a shot in the arm to the economy and, you know, during a recession. So anyway,
I would just say two things. The opinion is going to vary. It's going to vary widely on that topic. Just, I know so, The other thing is I want to stick up for the accountant because I think the accountant was actually driving an old company car that he even handed down to his son. So, like, I don't think the accountant was the one pocketing all the money. Just putting that out there.
All right. Look, it's a hypothetical accountant, Matt. it's not the accountant that you and I might be thinking of, but
it's not the accountant for Matt's story or the Marty Bird or whatever.
Yeah. That's it.
So this is an important thing, you know, and one big piece that I think would be readily apparent to a foreign observer who's not in the U.S. is that it's incredibly confusing how many mixed messages you get about the debt over the years. You know what I mean? Like to your point, Noel, it does depend a lot on administration, but also these investments can be a tough sell because we can make good guesses about how much they will benefit the average person in the U.S., but those are guesses over time. And unfortunately, the human species does not have the best track record of saying, I'll sacrifice even a little bit of my today to massively improve things for people 15 years from now that I may never meet. I'll just say, I don't know, man, $2, 15 cents, right. That's like a cheeseburger money.
Oh, totally. I want to add one final thing. This notion of China calling in its debt or like, you know, say, okay, that's it, pay up. There's a really great article that summarizes a lot of this stuff in a really straightforward way on thebalance.com. And there's a whole section on this article, if China called in its debt holdings. And it's exactly like you say, Ben, with your traffic analogy. If China called in its debt, demand for the dollar would plummet. The dollar collapse would then cause chaos in international markets, way worse than what we saw in 2008. And guess who else would suffer along with us? China. So it is that mutually assured finance, maybe not destruction. And it certainly is like a flex and a finger on that detonator that they could, you know, wield politically if they wanted to. And I'm sure they do in some ways, but it doesn't make sense. And they certainly wouldn't do it all at once. This article points out they would probably do it slowly, sell off its treasury holdings slowly. And even at that slow pace, the demand would still drop, which would still hurt China's competitiveness. And to your point, Ben, with the expansion they're going for, that's not something they want to do. So I think the takeaway from the Oliver piece is like, y'all just slow your roll. It's not that bad. And it's, you know, how are we spending this? What are we getting out of it? Those are the questions you should be asking. And stop, you know, using children as a scapegoat politically. We're like, what about the children? We only care about the children when it's like a soapbox moment. But yeah.
I would agree. I can't help it, you guys. I hear all the facts you're saying. I hear all the points that John Oliver made. It still bothers me fully that as a country, we're so deeply in debt.
Yeah, that's how the system's designed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just like really quickly, like, I mean, we're in debt to Brazil, Hong Kong, Luxembourg, Ireland, the UK, China and Japan just happen to be the two biggest pieces of the pie. Also Switzerland. And then again, like to what we talked about earlier, the largest holders of that U.S. debt are our own citizens, which to me feels like you're investing in your own country. And that doesn't seem so bad.
Yeah. One of the secrets about the necessity of debt here, without going into, you know, balance and trade and so on. One of the secrets, at least for the U.S., is that having other countries hold U.S. debt strengthens the hegemonic nature of the dollar as a global reserve currency. You know what I mean? We talk about the petrodollar, but again, concept of a dollar is a pretty intangible thing. It's literally an article of faith. So the more people you have treating it like a real thing, the more places and people you're going to have accepting it as currency. You know what I mean? A dollar is a very useful thing to have around the world. And part of it is because so many other countries need it to be real. I mean, what if it crashed like Beanie Babies or Pogs? Japan and China would rightly be livid because they, you know, I guess there are like maybe three people in the audience today who are going, oh, yeah, I lost the farm on Beanie Babies. But that's kind of what would happen if everybody like agreed that the dollar was worthless, which goes back to your point, Noel, about connected chaos. Mm-hmm. Well, debt can be power.
The problem is it won't matter if inflation hits hard, right? And we've seen that before. And inflation is one of the things that can happen. Even John Oliver talked about, as long as inflation doesn't increase, all of this is fine. I would just say, I think that is, I don't know. Well, I don't mean to disagree with you guys. I just think inflation is way more of a specter than a scary specter than we want to believe.
And I'm sorry, I misunderstand what you're saying. Inflation happens kind of, I guess not naturally, I mean, but it happens year over year. Inflation is the phenomenon of like a dollar being able to buy you more in 1932 than it does in 1998, because over time inflation just happens. Are you saying there's some event or series of events that would trigger massive inflation overnight that is out of proportion with that gradual inflation over time?
No. Really, there isn't much that happens in the financial world that happens overnight besides, you know, stuff in the stock market, which is very possible. But yeah, the inflation is the one thing, you know, that took down Germany, right? We talked about that. Inflation took it down, the Weimar Republic. We just have to be careful. I don't know. It still worries me. I think my problem, guys, is that when I watched that John Oliver segment, he gives me a sense of calm or an ease, even though we're talking about hard topics a lot of times. And I think every once in a while, I feel as though I can't trust the feeling that I get, maybe.
That's fair. I think there's plenty of other things to be anxious about. It's nice to be able to at least sort of check one off the list, but it's not like it's, you know, hard and fast. But I think we've spent enough podcast ink on this one for now, but something to keep an eye on. But let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and then we'll be back with one more strange news.
And we have returned. Our final story in this week's segment takes us to the far north, literally as far north as you can go and still be on planet Earth. Folks, as we record today, the race for the Arctic continues. We did a previous episode on this, who will control the Arctic, long story short, for a number of decades now, the ice caps in the North Pole have been melting. I'm sure you have seen many, many think pieces, many studies, many news stories on the various terrible consequences of the ice caps melting. But there is one group of huge benefits, and it may even, in some way, depending on where you live, benefit you. When those ice caps melt, when the water unfreezes and becomes navigable for ships, there is an entirely new, unique trade route available. So it goes back to what we were talking about previously with the strange shell game of international trade. Essentially, all the if you imagine in your mind a map of the North Pole, all the countries that are around the Arctic Circle, and even countries that don't really have a geophysical claim to it, they're all trying to slice out the pie and be the person or be the entity that controls the trade routes, right? And be the entity that also controls the mining rights for minerals, for fossil fuels, and what have you. Right now, a lot of people are incredibly nervous because the Russian military, which I think we may have talked about this before, they've been going hard on the paint to have this access for a long time. And, you know, they have a decent claim, because if you look at the map, a ton of Russia butts right into the North Pole, or the Arctic Circle, we should say. And right now, a lot of international observers are incredibly nervous because it turns out that Russia has doubled down on their military buildup in the Arctic, and they've done some things that they haven't done before. First off, because of the nature of the climate in Russia and the Arctic Circle, they already had a lot of infrastructure that was set to function pretty well in the Arctic North. However, the issue is that they had a lot of, just like with the U.S. infrastructure, they had a lot of infrastructure problems. They weren't maintaining things the way they needed to be maintained. But for the record, if you're feeling adventurous, you can take a ride on a Russian icebreaker, nuclear powered. It's called the 50 Let Pobedy, which means 50 years of victory. Anyway, that aside, they're building this massive agglomeration of military might, which is an intimidation move, but also it's kind of trying to be the first to the gate in a world where possession is very much 9/10 of the law. This has happened before. Russia has been planning this for a long time. These kinds of explorations have occurred. You may, in fact, fellow conspiracy realists, recall a moment several years ago when Russia planted an underwater flag as like the old school colonialism, right? I got a flag, I put it here, this is mine, dibs on this entire continent or this entire mass. But what's different now is that they have a new toy, a very dangerous toy. It's called the Poseidon 2M39 torpedo. But while torpedo it may be, it's a little misleading. It's a lot more like that unmanned submarine that your guy was designing, Matt, before he killed all those cows. I'd like to talk a little bit about what the Poseidon is. It's autonomous, unmanned, it's nuclear powered, it's called a super weapon. And honestly, although I usually think that kind of stuff is hyperbole, guys, this is very much not. It's about the size of a small submarine, and the idea is that it'll be used against hostile bases or naval stations. But it has, so the problem with the Poseidon is that it is quite potentially capable of rendering an entire area unlivable. I'm going to send you guys, it's like using a chainsaw when a steak knife would do. I'm going to send you guys a picture here in our group chat where you can see something called a nuke map. The Poseidon is capable of creating a 100 megaton explosion. And if you look at this map, nuke map, by the way, is a really cool tool, then you can model out the detonation of what would happen, like how this thing, this bomb with this yield, how it would affect the world. So if you look at the map now, you'll see just from that screen cap that we wanted to see what happened if the Poseidon somehow was deployed in New York. The fallout goes clear to the Gulf Coast.
Jeez. Holy shit. Wow.
Yeah. So that's rain?
Yeah. Oh, I see. So it's, because of all the water, it's probably like, I see.
Yeah, radioactive rain and fallout, essentially, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's pretty messed up. Wow.
It also irradiates the water. So we're talking, if this thing was ever used, it would, according to multiple breathless headlines, create radioactive tsunami. This isn't technically true unless the payload is far more destructive than imagined.
Ben, that's from the Tsar Bomba,
the largest bomb?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's I apologize. I had to walk away for 1 second for my family. But it was that's the yield of these Poseidon torpedoes.
Yeah, it's they're believed to. We don't know everything about them. They're one of six super weapons that were proposed by the Russian administration in 2018. This Poseidon is what's called a cobalt bomb, and. You know, there's a tragic story here. There's always a tragic story when you talk about nuclear weaponry and physicists. But the physicist who first proposed the idea of a cobalt bomb was not to have it built. Leo Szilard, I believe, literally said, look, I'm not showing you all that this is possible because anyone should build one. I'm showing you that we're getting to the point where nuclear technology can quite literally end human life on Earth. This should be considered a doomsday device. And then, you know, shout out to that great Mitchell and Webb sketch about the inventor who keeps trying to make peaceful weapons of war. The problem here is that these sorts of weapons, they don't respect international boundaries. You know what I mean? They don't go through customs. If you fire this at a naval base, it's not going to stop at the perimeter of the naval base. This will have real and lasting implications. We're talking about the nuclear equivalent of sowing the earth with salt. It will render large swaths of any shoreline nearby unlivable. So what this means, first off, is that it's scary to imagine the situation where the Russian government might decide to deploy this weaponry. It also means, I'm going to sneak one other thing in here before we close, it also means that it's a perfect toy for Vladimir Putin's administration because he just signed that law I told you guys about a few months ago.
Remind me?
Where he could be president forever.
That's right. Okay, sorry. I thought that's what you're referring to. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, sorry. Any Russian president.
Correct.
And just any Russian president.
We know it. Yeah. We know what you were up to, Vladimir.
So this means that he quite possibly, if no health conditions or assassins or accidents cross his path, he could become the ruler in office for the longest time since Joseph Stalin. So it's a little more difficult to imagine something that would disincentivize him. Like if domestic Russian opinion said, hey, don't put out this bomb, then he could say, what are you gonna not elect me? It's very dangerous for your health.
Very. Oh man. Yeah, this sounds terrifying all around, Ben.
Yeah, which is a shame because I still really want to ride on that icebreaker. And this is where I want to pass the question to you, our fellow listeners in the audience. What do you think the future of the Arctic will be? What direction do you see things going in here? What's the long-term goal of Russia? What should the long-term goal of the rest of the world be? And is losing the North Pole and the ice there, is it worth gaining this trade route over the long term? I would argue probably not. But again, as our previous story showed, we're not expert economists. So want to hear your view. Also, have you built a cocaine submarine? Let us know. Have you, what's your opinion on national debt?
And I want to add to that end really quickly, if you are interested in the minutiae of that national debt, there's a really cool active graphical site called usdebtclock.org that not only shows you the tick, tick, ticking up of that national debt, but it shows you all these other amazing stats. And you can tell which ones are in the positive or the negative by whether they're green or red. But it shows you median income, median debt, of a citizen or taxpayer, et cetera. And all of it's active and tied to, stats that are constantly updating in real time. So it's really interesting, but also kind of terrifying, but hopefully a little less terrifying after our conversation today.
And if you'd like to learn more about the ins and outs of Russia in the Arctic, which I am telling you, folks, it's an important story that should be more widely reported at the moment. Please do check out some works by the Carnegie Endowment. Please do also check out some of the excellent reporting over at Haaretz and The Guardian as well. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. We cannot wait to hear from you. You can write to us, you can call us, you can contact us any number of ways, and you might just end up on our weekly listener mail segment. That sounds like a deal, you say. I want to do that before a nuclear torpedo destroys my country. How do I get in contact with you? Well, we try to be very easy to find online.
Yeah, the internet. So it's a wild and woolly place. But we're on there in multiple locations. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are Conspiracy Stuff, Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. Why not join our Facebook group? Here's where it gets crazy to get in on the conversation in real time, just like that National Debt Clock website.
That national debt clock, I believe, is brought to us by the Durst family, at least the original.
The one in New York City, yeah, Manhattan, the Dursts of the, how does Oliver put it? The murder, bathroom murder Durstees or something like that? It's pretty funny. But yeah, it's a thing. And it's, you know, and he makes a nice joke of it not being an actual clock, because that's not how clocks work. But
yeah, and the company or the group that was paid to make that submarine for the first episode we talked about today, they, according to them at least, they had no idea it was going to be used for those purposes. They thought it was just a special submarine that latches to the bottoms of, you know, ships.
It's true. I had no idea, you know. I'm a small business owner. You just cash the check and do the specs, all right?
That's right. But yes, as you're saying, Noel, you don't have to do that stuff. You can head on over to our phone number. How do you do that? Well, you pick up your phone, you dial this number, 1-833-STDWYTK. Wait for Ben. He'll tell you what to do. Then you've got 3 minutes. Tell us the name you'd like for us to call you, whether or not we can use your message on air. Leave your message. Then if you want to say anything at the end just for us, please put it there. If you need to go over 3 minutes for any reason, we recommend, instead of leaving multiple messages, send all that good info to us via email. You can always reach us. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.